Indeed, indeed, indeed. And by the way, have you been to the coasttocoastam.com website? Just go there once a day, twice a day, look it over, make it one of your favorites. So you don't have to spell it out all the time, but there's some great information there. If you're not following us on Facebook and Twitter, you can do that very easily. Go right up to the top of the right-hand corner, click Facebook and Twitter, and you can follow us there as well. Back in a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. We're going to take your calls now here on Coast to Coast AM. Jim, of course, was going to be able to answer many of your questions, but he's gone. We don't know what happened to him. We keep calling his phone, and it keeps going to an answering service, and he's not picking up on his cell phone. He has disappeared. The moment he was talking about something controversial, talking about skeletons, huge, giant skeletons, he disappears. Now, that could be one of the weird ones for the record book. We're going to keep trying him, but I'm not sure. There's something wrong here. Something's going on. This is going to be conspiracy again. I don't know, Danny, should I even try dialing him on the air? It'll go straight to the answering machine. Unbelievable. Oh, we found him. Where'd you go?
I was here.
No, you weren't.
We're having an ice storm here in Massachusetts.
Well, I know. We kept getting an answering machine.
Oh, I apologize.
It must be your wife on the answering machine. That's her voice. Okay, but you're back, huh?
Yes, I apologize.
Tell me about the ice storm.
Well, it's we're getting this mixture of ice and snow, and the lines. I'm up at like 1,700 foot elevation, so it's a little dicey up where I live on a mountain.
Yeah, you got to be careful there, Joe.
Yes.
My God, you drive up there or walk? How do you get up there?
Well, we have four-wheel drive. It's just, there's a road that goes over the top. It's the oldest road in the county, but it's very icy and treacherous in the winter.
A typical New England winter.
Yes.
It's going to be a bad one this year, I predict. All right, we're going to take phone calls with you, Jim, as we continue talking about this bizarre story. I thought for a moment that they came and got you. We don't want that to happen.
I know. That's funny. I wonder what it really means. You know, like, is it one of those subjects that's really...
the button's too hot to push?
Yeah. You wouldn't think so, but, God, you never know.
All right, let's take some calls. You ready?
I'm ready.
Wichita, Kansas, we go east. Marty, take it away. Hi, Marty.
Good morning. It's wonderful to speak to you on the show here.
You too.
The reason I'm calling is because I will have a theory on perhaps why the Smithsonian would appear to perhaps be hiding these skeletons. I've been aware of this for some time, and my theory is that, well, there's no doubt that the Smithsonian, they teach evolution. They're kind of sold out to the whole evolution concept.
Mm-hmm.
And this would seem to almost go against evolution if these are skeletons from the past. Evolution says that we started off small. We're getting bigger, living longer, getting smarter and faster and stronger.
Instead, we're getting bigger and getting smaller. You're breaking up a little bit there, but let's get your reaction to that, Jim. How political is the Smithsonian?
Extremely. One of the comments that I made that got a lot of buzz was I talked about the Koch brothers. David H. Koch has a permanent installation named after him called the David H. Koch Hall of Human Origins at the Smithsonian. He donated $15 million and essentially has global climate scientists infuriated. They whitewashed the whole subject. In the interactive game at the display, as reported by Jane Mayer in her piece for the New Yorker magazine, says that, you know, essentially we don't know what's causing changes in the climate, and that in the future, humans may adapt to climate change by, quote-unquote, living in underground cities, growing short, compact bodies with curved spines so as better to move around in tight spaces. So you have the Koch brothers, giving money to the Smithsonian to create this preferred view of history. And I just used as an example of, you know, they're to be bought, you know, by the highest bidder, essentially, in many matters. And Lawrence Small, from 2000 to 2007, former Citibank and Fannie Mae executive, who was the head of the Smithsonian, resigned in disgrace after congressional hearings revealed, you know, financial impropriety after internal audit. All these things. It's just another bloated, corrupt institution.
Well, what are they afraid? What are they afraid of losing if they came out and said
credibility, funding?
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They get over $800 million a year. Senator Charles Grassley is constantly on him, trying to get him to comply with Freedom of Information Act, which they can't or they don't. They're just another bloated, corrupt institution, and institutions just don't act with humanism or rationality. They just, you know, it's like Penn State or the Vatican, right? You stake out a position, and then you have to be dragged to the confessional. That doesn't mean that the place isn't staffed with credible, honest, hardworking, intelligent anthropologists, archaeologists, and scientists. But at its highest level, it's just another revolving door of in and out. Like Rubenstein from the Carlyle Group, right? He's on the Board of Regents there and a big contributor. And can I get on the Board of Regents? You know, the Carlyle Group, Cuomo just brought this lawsuit about, you know, on top of them with all kinds of corruption. That, you know, from my studying of the CIA and the NSA in the 80s and 90s, they kept coming up as a vile and corrupt organization. And, you know, it's the way of the world. It's like the system doesn't want to be questioned at any turn.
Do you think if they ever found evidence, let's say of Jesus, that these institutions would sequester it as well?
Of course, yes. Yeah, it's just really, it's troubling. But I think like my research, because of Google Books, I mean, I had to hand read thousands of pages of town histories. And then I started, you know, to really accumulate all this stuff. And then I realized that I got into Google Books and searches. And because of Google Books, this whole vast library is open that has never been opened in human history. Now, I can compile thousands of these accounts. And, you know, I really feel that this is getting out there, this information. It is getting much more difficult. If the system could put the internet back in the box, it would in a heartbeat. And I think this is the way all this information is spreading so rapidly. And researchers are connecting so quickly. And like your caller was saying, absolutely, that there was a preferred view of reality. And I separate my theorizing from my hard evidence, you know, and, you know, I want the two to remain distinct. I have this mountain.
But sometimes they mesh, don't they?
They definitely, because I want to, once you get in these things, you got to theorize, like, what does it mean? What's really going on? And what is the story with evolution? Could it be genetic engineering? You know, something is vastly wrong with the way we're told, you know, about, and through oral history and written accounts, I've just kind of unraveled a completely different take on history than we're told, that's for sure.
Let's go next to Jamie in Folsom, Montana, west of the Rockies. Hey, Jamie, go ahead.
Oh, yes.
Hi.
I need to tell you that in southern Illinois, my husband and I, on two different occasions, visited these mounds.
Cahokia.
Where?
In Cahokia.
Yes. Well, anyway, they have since closed these mounds down to the public because I had postcards. I sent them all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, these mounds, you could go, they had this one particular one that you could go in and you go above on these concrete walkways and look down inside where they had unearthed all of these burial stands, which were on basically concrete rock formations. And the father was on the bottom, then the mother, and then the next child, the next child, next child on top of one another. And they were completely petrified. And they had been there since, I mean, thousands of years.
What do we know? What's the latest there,
well,
Jimmy?
Here's the deal with these, though. Here's what happened. They died of some particular bone disease. Now, the father and the mother were 8-9 feet tall.
Wow.
Every single one of them. Even the babies were huge.
And you're saying they don't let you in anymore?
Well, no. Now, here's the deal. I had a bone disease, and so I sent one of these postcards to the chief bone surgeon at Loma Linda and inquired, you know, is there any danger of going in there and these people working and digging and unearthing and any of this kind of, you know, dust getting into a person's lungs and maybe, you know, coming back? And, you know, it was about a year later, they closed those mounds. And I got a letter from the Chamber of Commerce from that town saying that because they were sacred burial grounds and due to the strange whatever, they did close those.
But they didn't say anything about health purposes.
Well, they didn't.
No, they
Now, what year was this?
This was in the 90s.
Really? And are you? Was it Cahokia?
This was in the late 90s.
I think it was Cahokia. Had to be down there. There's, how many?
I know it was on the road that went past where Lincoln was born because his little log cabin.
That was Springfield, Illinois. So you passed that up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you familiar with the name of the site or the burial mounds that was
called? If I was not in my bedroom on this phone, I would go out and get my atlas and pull out Illinois and could easily find it for you.
Yeah, no,
As
no.
As a matter of fact, I still have one of those postcards. In one of my old Bibles.
Well, I'm sure it says Cahokia Mounds. Those places are old. Didn't they shut some of them down, though, Jim? They thought they could collapse on people?
Well, the Cahokia, there was a side that was...
falling apart.
Falling apart, and they had to stabilize it. Yeah, but, you know, really, there hasn't been, you know, much excavation. They're really kind of... I think the Native American Repatriation and Graves Act has been used as a weapon against further study of the earthen mounds, and you know, because it's not like the Smithsonian has come clean and returned all their remains for repatriation. They seem to be grandfathered in, and they're not required to like send all the skeletal remains back to be buried with respect.
Have they tried to X-ray the mounds?
Good question. Like
all my questions,
ground penetrating radar. That's a good question. Yeah. No, I often think of like
or ultrasound, you know, whatever they use.
Yeah, some form of technology to see. And it wasn't like this happened all in 1840 or something. You know, the Sparrow Mounds in Oklahoma were opened in the 30s, and a lot of it was like, you know, relic hunter type of stuff, not like sound archaeological investigation. You know, the lack of respect that was had for the, you know, the mounds and the burial places. I mean, really, it's the burial places. Well, one thing is when a conquering civilization comes in, that happens all around the globe, they destroy the burial places of the former heroes. There's just no question about it. And that's what happened. And I really think, yeah, that there was, you know, the Smithsonian was the arm of the establishment, the Eastern Mounds Division. They didn't just excavate the mounds and take the artifacts and make sure the troublesome artifacts disappeared and the skeletal remains. They basically bulldozed, you know, hundreds of thousands of mounds, you know, to just really advocated the destruction of the Native American civilization. So that, to me, that's what's like so nauseating about the whole story is like there's no respect for one of the greatest and most amazing civilizations in human history, you know. Like, the head of the Smithsonian in the 90s did not know Monk's Mound existed, did not, you know? It's like not knowing the pyramids were there.
Yeah, that's crazy. That is
really
crazy.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to Brian now, York, Pennsylvania, east of the Rockies. Hey, Brian, go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. Hey. I was just wondering if he ever touched on the subject that those giant skeletons might be the Iwanaki.
As a matter of fact, we were talking about them being the Nephilim. I'm not so sure if they'd be the Anunnaki.
That's a good question. It's funny. I read Sitchin's stuff years ago, and then it just...
Classic work.
Yeah. And then I put it aside. I just, you know, kind of, like as a kid, I said, well, this is, you know, it's like Eric Von Daniken's stuff. This is really interesting. And then, you know, I went to college and got into other kinds of studies. And then it came back around that he, you know, the Sumerian texts talk about the Anunnaki. And I think something is going, you know, genetically something is going on that has happened that doesn't fit conventional theory. I really think there's like genetic engineering happened in the past or something's happening because it just doesn't make sense. You know, It might be what Sitchin said, or it might be something else, but it seems like, you know, why hasn't anthropology ever been able to find the missing link? And why are these, you know, when you look at giant skeletons and things like this, it just doesn't line up with Darwinism. You know, something else is in play. And I, you know, can't claim to have all the answers, but, you know, his work's pretty compelling. That's for sure.
Do you have any scientists who agree with you?
It's funny. If I take my work to geologists and other professionals, they're like, wow, that's amazing. George Sheldon and, you know, New York Times. And I'll take it to anthropologists and archaeologists. And, you know, I worked with an anthropologist who was part of the repatriation team. One thing at the Pecumtuck Museum in Deerfield, in their records, the 1883 records of curiosity and relics, they have listed skeletal remains of an over 8-foot skeleton from Ohio that was actually on display at the museum that was reinterred as part of the Native American Repatriation Act. And I talked to the physical anthropologist who repatriated those remains. I'm sitting down having breakfast with her, and she's talking about double rows of teeth, and she's like, I don't understand. She's showing me an anthropological guidebook with pictures of supernumerary or extra teeth. So I'm saying, no, complete rows in the upper and bottom, double rows. And I'm showing their accounts, and then accounts from Minnesota. A guy comes up to our table, and he's smiling. And he says, I really enjoyed your lecture at Greenfield Community College last week, especially about the giants with the double rows of teeth.
Huh.
He said, I was born with double rows of teeth, and I had them removed. And so the anthropologist awkwardly says, can I look in your mouth? And she says, is there any genetic connection? And he said, yes, my identical twin has double rows of teeth, and he hasn't had them removed. And she was theorizing that this, which they are, if you talk to a dentist, that genetic trait still exists in humans.
So you think he's an offspring of the giants?
He was tall, that's for sure. He's like 6'4". So
you never know.
Yeah, it was very interesting that he came, like, synchronistically, as I was talking to the anthropologist about double rows of teeth, he came up with that story. So I found that kind of a, like, you're in the right, going in the right direction sign.
You know? How long ago do you think these giants roamed the planet?
You know, a couple thousand years ago. You know, the carbon dated remains, you know, the Adena, the Hopewell, 1000 BC, 200 AD, 500 AD. But one thing that's not well known is that in the wars against Native Americans, there were many times accounts of, you know, fearsome warriors of giants that fought alongside as part, you know, that were like the chieftains and the warriors, King mm-hmm. Philip.
Yeah, like but there are those stories out there. And of course, the Cain and Abel's story is, I mean, they weren't giants, but David and Goliath, that's another one. We're going to come back in just a moment with you, Jimmy. We're going to take more phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, this Friday, Beyond Belief, our television show, it's going to be all about the Mayan calendar, so make sure you're part of it. You get 10 days free. Go take a look at it. In addition to, by the way, a lot of people saying, well, what else do we get with your TV show, George? And you get access to the entire Guyam library of incredible videos. So just take a look at the website. There's a direct link for you, hosts at the top of coasttocoastam.com. Just open that up, and it says TV project. And then just click that. It'll take you straight there. It is Guyam TV, GAIAMTV.com/George. And again, 10 days free to take a look at all of that. Jim Vieira with us. Jim, as a stonemason, is that a trade that is kind of waning, going away, or are some more and more people coming into it?
It's funny. Out where we live in Western Mass, there's one mason named Sonam Lama, and he escaped Tibet and the occupation of the Chinese, and there was a PBS special on him, and he's brought over a lot of Tibetans to be trained as stonemasons in Massachusetts. You know, I think it's a profession that's steady, but it's kind of a luxury item at the same time.
Right. Are jobs prevalent or is it tight?
It's tight.
Yeah.
I got it. My brother and I both have herniated discs.
Oh.
And I remember the day I did, I was picking up, must have been 1,500 pounds. I was grabbing one side. I mean, we were former decathletes and athletes, so, you know, being a tough guy and not using our heads, I never used heavy equipment or correct means, which I have to now. And yes, it's a herniated disc.
Is not oh my God. Now, as a stonemason, do you deal with brick too, or is that this somebody else?
We do all dry laid stuff. We work with quarried stone, and we do like meticulously tight patios and walls that are, you know, really super tight jointed, but we don't use any mortar. We do everything dry laid. And
interesting field.
Yeah, we built stone sets for a production at a double-edged theater in town, actually. They did the Odyssey for 2 years, and they're recognized by the UN, and we built stone towers and standing stones and walls. And so we like to do artistic work also.
I've always wanted to do a nightclub styled after my cave, my studio in St. Louis. What's it cost, you know, to put, like, fencing, and then it looks like it's like a rock?
Like a veneer, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, we're blessed to have one of the best quarries, you know, in the country, about a mile from my house, Ashfield Stone. They cut, I'll say they make countertops for like De Niro's bar and Jerry Seinfeld, and beautiful, stuff they polish with diamond saws. It's not that expensive. It's like $300 a ton for veneers, for like 4-inch veneers. And, you know, you would need to ship it there. And if,
But I mean, it would look like the inside of a cave, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
That's not bad. All right, let's take some calls. Rick is in Springfield, Illinois, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, hi, George. Glad to be able to talk to you. Been a longtime listener. Clear back with Art Bell, and now with you for 10 years.
Thank you, Rick. Hard to believe 10 years already, huh?
Oh, man.
Wow.
The time flies, don't it?
We're getting old, Rick.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. I wanted to ask your guest there. It's a very good show, by the way. I've been to Cahokia probably 3 or 4 times in my life, and it's a fascinating place.
Sure.
And I did read, and I don't remember, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, where they were doing construction because it was falling in. And then shortly after that, I read where they were closing it down, and I don't know why. I have no idea why. But I thought that was kind of strange.
Jim, you would know, huh?
Philip Reif has. There are many authors. Ross Hamilton is really good. He wrote a book called The Tradition of Giants, and I've been working with Ross, and I think Jimmy Carter has a copy of his book right now. Ross told me he's a history buff, and it's a really scholarly work. But there are other authors too, like Fritz Zimmerman has hundreds of accounts of giant skeletons in his book. But Philip Reif, The Goliath Conspiracy, he has an account from Cahokia of a giant found with double rows of teeth at the Cahokia site, and it's in his bibliography listed. Just like the Great Pyramid in Egypt, right, and the Sphinx, why are they building that massive wall around it? It just seems like, you know, something is going on at Cahokia that, you know.
They don't want us to know about.
Absolutely. The massive stone chamber underneath you.
And what do you think's in that chamber? Guess. What do you think?
I will get a little esoteric on you and say that I had a reading with Douglas James Cottrell, the modern-day Edgar Casey. He is a trance medium in Canada. And when you can't figure it out, you could call him, you know.
He's like a remote viewer?
Yes.
Down he goes.
He goes into which he's really good. He's just like Casey. He has a million videos on YouTube, Douglas James Cottrell. So anyways, I asked him questions about what is this with the double rows of teeth. He said that they are what Edgar Casey described as the genetic creations of the Atlanteans, the things, quote unquote, that the creatures or the beings with double rows of teeth were actually genetic creations. And then I told him to look inside Cahokia in the chamber. And he said he didn't find any skeletal remains. What he saw was lots of mica, lots of amazing ornaments, like a translucent-like substance. He, you know, basically described the temple chamber, which, frankly, is what you found at Kanawha at Grave Creek. You would, when they excavated a lot of these mounds, they found temple chambers in the middle of them, stone chambers,
you know, with giant skeletons with copper armor, copper crowns, amazing artifacts. So I imagine it's some kind of a amazing ceremonial structure that if it were open today, it would open people's eyes to the amazing reality of ancient America.
Let's go to David driving in Missouri, first-time caller. David, go ahead. Thank you.
Yes, sir. George, Jim, how are you guys doing this evening?
Good.
What an interesting conversation.
Fascinating stuff. Go ahead, David.
I happen to live in a little sleepy town called Peebles, Ohio, about 45 minutes south of Chillicothe. Right down the road in another little town is a place called Serpent Mound, which is, if I'm not mistaken, one of the largest remaining earth effigies that the mound builders had built.
Yes.
With that, in 2008, I got laid off, and that's where I stumbled across this information vehicle known as Coast to Coast, and Stephen Quayle, and another website known as Out of Place Artifacts, where they talked about the Adena and this super race of Indians that came up from Mexico to build these mounds. And I just wanted to get your opinion on that, Jim. I missed part of what you had said earlier.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The Adena, it's funny, the Don Dragoo, the curator for the section of man at the Carnegie, I think from 1952 to 1977, he wrote, he was the last great Adena scholar. And I think with the Creasp mound, he excavated and he found 7-foot skeletons. And he talks about the massive jawbones. And this isn't, you know, in 1840. This is Don Dragoo from the Carnegie. And the spots that you're talking about, Chillicothe and Peebles, I would recommend Ross Hamilton's book. He has a lot of accounts around Ohio that talk about giant skeletons being unearthed. The Great Serpent Mound, the largest effigy mound in the world, I believe, a quarter mile long. It was the Hopi believed that their ancestors actually built it.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to believe that the mound builders came, like Edgar Casey says, and other researchers like Greg Little talk about, came up from the Yucatan. When you look at Cahokia, when you look at the structures of, you know, the Mississippians and, you know, the Hopewell, you know, they look like Mesoamerican structures sometimes. They look like stone pyramids built with earth. And Cahokia has a huge plaza with a wood henge. And, you know, it just really feels to me that there was some influence there. And the artifacts seem to indicate that there was a connection. At the Hopewell site, at one of the Hopewell sites in Illinois, you have artifacts. You have obsidian from Wyoming, shark's teeth from Maryland, pearls and shells from the Gulf Coast, silver from Canada. So there was this massive trade route all around the country in ancient America.
You know, Jim, with what's been happening all over this planet, Egypt, elsewhere, China, it seems that the technology was the same, doesn't it?
Yes.
I find that baffling.
Within the context of what we're told, but, you know, if you look at a global maritime civilization that was sophisticated, you know, in ways that we can't even comprehend, over 10,000 years old, just like many oral traditions talk about, and the, you know, the evidence shows that it makes sense. You have pyramids all around the planet. You have pyramids with Pi on both sides of the Atlantic. Is that an accident? There was no contact. There was no shared school of mathematics, geometry, and engineering, and spirituality. You know, shamanism is in every corner of the planet. It seems like that all these notions, ideas, and sciences came from one place or two continents. You know, one in the Pacific, one in the Atlantic. I just, studying Edgar Casey, for, you know, really, he's like, talk about historical detective work. He talked about the Nile flowing backwards, which was eventually proven by satellite imagery. He talked about the Essenes having women in their group, which was proven by the Dead Sea Scrolls after he died. You know, I really feel like...
Well, and his map of North America is frightening. I hope it never happens, but he's probably right.
Well, his retrocognitive statements are very accurate. He's had some, you know, pole shift in 1998. I think once you start looking into the future, variables change the future. But if you can look into the past,
to events that happened, you know, it seems like retrocognitively he's much more accurate. So, but yes, I've seen his map of the future, and yeah, let's hope it doesn't come to that.
No, not at all. Let's go to Lori in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hi, Lori, go ahead.
Hey, guys. I'm out here in Colorado Springs. I have one word for your guest tonight, Jim. Jim, guess what? Woohoo! Thank God for you! I have my PhD in forensic archaeology, and I want to run by a couple things with you guys real quick before you hang up on me, Mr. George Snorri.
All right, that's because you just called, didn't you?
Let the goddess bless Jim more than he's ever been blessed in his entire lifetime.
Awesome.
I hope to God that happens, because I can't believe, number one, don't take this wrong, I am so glad he's a man with passion and heart, because if we don't understand our past, we have no clue about our future. And you know this, Mr. Snorri, because I've listened to you talk for quite a while.
You're right.
And Jim, you are one in a million. One in a million. I have my PhD in forensic archaeology in Colorado. I am going to say something on this show, and it's going to be put out there, and it's out. The cat is out of the bag. I've been studying my own archaeology sites, and I stumbled across them in my own yard in 1997. The University of Colorado came out to see me finally around 2003 on their own money. The university would even pay for the archaeology team to come out and see me. So they got their own money and came out and see me. And I showed them several sites, and they compared me to Logsdon Linke and called me an anomaly. Jim, you are right on the money. You have no clue. I have pictures I'd like to send you guys if you'd like to see them. I'd like to tell you really quickly about Colorado Springs. There have been bodies found, ancient burials, several times. And every single time I try to see the bodies, the pictures are gone. They're not at the university. Huh.
Are they giants?
Yeah, I don't know, but I'm going to tell you something real exciting. Hang on. Please give me a couple seconds. I'm going to make your guys' day. I'm going to make your day, and I'll give you an invitation, Jim. Yes, and anybody else that wants to come out, you got to sign a waiver and keep your mouth shut. I'm trying to be nice. Colorado Springs has been covering up the burial mounds that they've been finding for a very long time. I've even called people that I know who help, like the editor of the Gazette newspaper, David Lagosian, and I've even asked, please, can we find some pictures of these? And they can't find the articles. They disappear. But on my own, since 1997, I've discovered huge tools. Huge tools.
Yes.
I just wonder what the heck is going on. And I must be a dingbat and I'm making a mistake. And I showed people from the local college here at CU in Colorado Springs. I had a professor came out, and he treated me like crap at my $500,000 home. He told me I was basically an idiot. I kid you not. I still kept pursuing. I got my PhD in forensic archaeology. I used to be in school for forensic pathology. And I found a skull, a stone skull, and it's huge. And it's in a valley where there was a civilization. I found the whole freaking civilization.
How big do you think the person would have been?
I'm about to get this cat right out of the bag.
You better hurry up, because this cat's almost at the break.
I know. And invite you to come see it.
Well, you got to let me know what I'm going to come see. How big is it?
But you'd have to not tell anybody where it's at. I discovered a civilization where some kind of a huge flood came down from the Rocky Mountains, right below the mountainside, right below it, and wiped out a huge stone civilization and crushed it. And in that valley is this huge stone skull.
Wow.
I mean, huge. The nose is huge. The eyes are bigger than normal. And it's a stone skull because I studied pathology and I know anatomy and biology. Is whoever designed it knew what the dead looked like. But the tools and the weapons and despite what they've tried to teach us in America, they were building stone civilizations, not tents, not running around little buffaloes and a little bit of loincloth on them. They were building stone structures. They knew what the heck they were doing. They were designing stuff, even geometrical designs. And the trees. I found the mummified trees, and I've got pictures. I can send you guys.
All right, send them to George at coasttocoastam.com. A lot of energy there for a forensic anthropologist. That's a pretty good field, Jim.
Yeah, I was going to say, if she's still on, if you could Facebook me, I'd like to talk
to her. She can hear you.
Yes, and I'd say get Philip Reif's book because he gives a lot of firsthand accounts of stone cities and things like that found in the out west. And it sounds like you're right on. Giant tools is another thing. It's not just giant bones.
Of everything you've worked on, Jim, what fascinates you the most? The skeletons, the giants, what?
Atlantis.
Atlantis? You never even brought Atlantis up.
Well, if what is very compelling to me, it's funny. When she was talking about, when I gave my talk, I went on this rant at the end where I'm laying into the Koch brothers and stuff, but I'm saying a lot of people just caught on to the idea. I was talking about a society based on love and connection, not fear and separation, on you know, just cooperating and being a much more respectful society, that native civilizations, you know, they were stewards of the land for over 10,000 years. And, you know, the whole idea, Casey talks about the law of one in Atlantis and a civilization based on love and connection is just so appealing to me of, you know, my life is spent like in service to people, coaching, caring for people, just trying to be a kind person and a thoughtful person. You know, I have an adopted son who had a very difficult background, and I feel like you feel alive and you feel connected when you're doing, you know, really nice, loving things, you know?
Oh, you sure do. Jim, stay with us. Coming back, final hour to go with you and phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got your Facebook link all set up at coasttocoastam.com as well. I'm George Norrie. Don't touch your dial. We'll be right back.